From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we're joined by a panel of experts on the public health impacts of incineration. We'll be looking at the incineration of rubber and tire fragments, of plastics, of municipal waste, and also of medical waste. We'll learn about the varied array of substances that exit the smokestacks of incinerators, their impacts on human health, and we'll also discuss some of the alternatives to incineration. But first, some news from the world of public health. Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. This month marks the fifth anniversary of the settlement between the tobacco companies and all 50 state governments in the United States. The 50 states were suing the tobacco companies to recover some of the cost of treating individuals insured through the state Medicaid programs who suffered tobacco-related illnesses. At the time of the settlement in November 1998, the 50 governors unanimously committed to using a significant portion of the settlement funds on programs to prevent children from smoking and programs to help current smokers quit the habit. Tobacco use is the leading cause of preventable deaths, accounting for about one of every six deaths in the United States. The Centers for Disease Control recommended that the states devote at least 20% of the settlement money to smoking prevention activities. This month, the Center for Tobacco-Free Kids released a study to document how tobacco settlement money has actually been spent. The report found that only four states, Mississippi, Arkansas, Delaware, and Maine, have devoted a fifth of settlement money to smoking prevention. On the other hand, 33 states are spending less than half of the amount the CDC recommended, and five states are allocating no state money whatever to smoking cessation activities, despite the fact that they are receiving the full amount of tobacco settlement money. Facing significant budget shortfalls, states have cut spending on tobacco cessation by nearly 30% in the last 2 years. Notably, high-quality programs in Florida and Massachusetts are being nearly eliminated. While this report gives an indication of how tobacco settlement money has been used in the past, a disturbing finding in the report is the fact that 21 states have sold future rights to tobacco settlement money to investors in order to receive an upfront payment to help balance state budgets. This means that tobacco settlement money in those states will not be available for use on tobacco prevention in the future either. While the report is generally critical of the state's use of tobacco settlement money, on the positive side, it notes that when money is actually spent to promote tobacco prevention or cessation activities, that such programs succeed in accomplishing that. Especially notable has been the program in the state of Maine. Maine spends a higher proportion of its funds on prevention of smoking than any other state. After implementing programs to prevent kids from smoking after 1997, Maine saw that smoking among high school students dropped by 48% by the year 2003, and smoking among middle school kids dropped 59%, so that fewer than 1 in 12 middle school students in Maine smokes in the year 2003. While states were cutting smoking cessation programs, the tobacco companies were dramatically increasing their marketing activities by 66% between 1998 and 2001. This meant that for every dollar the states are spending to prevent tobacco use, the tobacco industry spends $20 promoting tobacco use. This report is available at the Tobacco Free Kids website, which is tobaccofreekids.org. This month, ABC News covered a story on the great concerns expressed among international public health workers about the implications of the huge sums of money going to the reconstruction of Iraq. The $33 billion pledged to Iraq in the next 4 years is more than 10 times the entire annual budget of the UN Development Program, which provides aid to over 100 underdeveloped nations. And the amount is also nearly 10 times greater than the total pledges to the United Nations Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria. Stephen Lewis, the UN envoy for AIDS in Africa, said that the situation in Iraq should not overshadow everything else, noting that Iraq is actually a middle-income country with 25 million people containing vast oil reserves. 42 million people worldwide are HIV positive, and most of them live in a state of poverty far more dire than the poverty experienced in Iraq. Due to lagging contributions, the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria developed a shortfall this year and has been forced to use anticipated pledges from future years to fund current programs. Following up on a topic we discussed in last month's airing of Public Health Radio, a study released November 6th by New York State Comptroller Alan Hevesi found that women in New York State would be spared 120,000 unintended pregnancies and 80,000 abortions every year if access to emergency contraception were improved in the state. Emergency contraception pills are basically a higher dose of ordinary birth control pills. When taken within 3 days after a suspected contraceptive failure, the pills have about an 80% chance of preventing pregnancy. Use of these pills is considered safe, and no long-term side effects have been identified despite many years of use. Emergency contraception is not readily available in many parts of the state. Overall, a survey of pharmacies found that statewide 54% of pharmacies carried at least one emergency contraception formulation. But that percentage varied widely, with about 90% of pharmacies in New York City, 70% in Albany, but only a third of pharmacies in Buffalo and Syracuse have even one formulation of emergency contraception available. 6 states allow emergency contraception to be available without a prescription, and the state of California joined their numbers just within the last month. The report issued by the New York State Comptroller advocates that New York also enact such legislation. The report is available at the Comptroller's website, osc.state.ny.us. Coming up next, the health impacts of incinerating rubber, plastic, and other components of municipal waste. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Last summer, the International Paper Company plant manager in Ticonderoga, New York, announced a plan to transform their boiler so that they could begin to obtain much of their energy from the incineration of shredded tires discarded from motor vehicles. A controversy arose because Lake Champlain and the Vermont state border are quite close to the plant, on the receiving end of the prevailing westerly winds, which predominate in the region. And the citizens in those areas were concerned about the environmental health impact of rubber incineration. But the issue of how to dispose of rubber, plastics, and other minimally biodegradable products of modern technology is by no means confined to our region. Municipalities across the country and abroad are grappling with the issue. As the planet becomes more crowded, landfill space is limited. Burning waste is a solution that is tempting to industry and to municipalities which are short on space to deposit discarded materials. The solids left behind after incineration take up far less space than the material that enters the incinerator. For the remainder of today's show, we'll be exploring several issues that incineration raises. What materials are produced by incinerating tires, plastics, and other common components of our waste stream? And what are the impacts of this incineration on public health? Finally, we'll briefly consider the question of whether there are viable alternatives to incineration. And we'll focus in some detail on the incineration of medical waste, which traditionally represented a substantial portion of toxic incineration across the U.S. Joining us today to discuss these issues are Paul Conant, Jorge Emanuel, and Neil Carman. Paul Conant is a professor of chemistry at St. Lawrence University. His research has focused on the interactions of heavy metals and dioxins with biological systems and the physical chemistry of waste incineration. Jorge Emanuel is a chemical engineer specializing in medical waste management. He is currently one of the lead consultants to the World Health Organization on a project to reduce medical waste incineration in developing countries. Neil Carman is a biologist who worked for many years at the Texas Air Control Board, the primary agency which investigates and regulates air pollution in the state of Texas. Paul Conant, Jorge Emanuel, and Neil Carman, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Neil Carman, maybe we can start with you. You've had firsthand experience with this same company over the very same issue. What are your thoughts on the incineration of shredded tires?
Well, International Paper proposed to do a pretty similar thing here in Texas, in East Texas, and I was contacted by mothers in the community about whether there could be an impact, such as their children might be affected. And so these were the mothers, and I basically said that it was a trade-off. It would be a good deal for the company, that they would save some money, but it would be a bad deal for the community, because these people live right on the fence line of this paper mill, and that there would be, according to the permit application that they submitted to the state, an increase in over 20 pollutants, and many of them toxic pollutants, metals, these polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which are benzene derivatives, phenol, and others, even benzene itself. And so basically, the mothers raised a storm of protest, and the company backed off, and that was just a year ago. So there can be an increase of many pollutants depending upon the size, the age, and the efficiency of the boiler unit and how much of the tire waste material they're putting in, whether they're putting it in as a whole tire. It's easier if they add chips, but it's a pretty dirty fuel. Basically, sometimes people try to say that the tires are cleaner than coal. They're, coal and waste tires are both very dirty fossil fuels. So basically, I do not advocate the burning of either whole tires or tire chips in either incinerators or boilers.
You mentioned benzene as a product of tire incineration. Benzene is notorious for causing leukemia and other bone marrow disorders. Why does it end up as an effluent from tire incineration?
Well, one of the reasons you could see increases in benzene is because there is a very common ingredient. One of the monomers used in a lot of synthetic rubber today is styrene, and styrene is basically a benzene derivative. It's known as vinyl benzene. So a very significant quantity of the material in modern synthetic tires is styrene. And so as the tire material begins to burn and burns incompletely, then the styrene or vinyl benzene can easily give off the benzene structure that's in it. And then you can also have new benzene created from, for example, 1,3-butadiene is another common monomer in the synthetic tire material. And this can spontaneously rearrange to form a benzene ring. And finally, the oil-extended rubber material, they're called oil extenders. And these are basically kind of like tank bottoms that come out of refineries. And in the rubber plants where they store this oiling material, they have cancer warning labels on every pipe and storage tank because these oil extenders are very, very toxic. And that's because of the benzene and the benzene derivatives that are, you know, in this oil material. And that's another significant chunk of what you'll find in these, tires.
Tell us about some other byproducts of tire incineration that may be of concern to human health.
The tires, by and large, of course, is a hydrocarbon, but in some of the tires, it includes a chlorinated material. Some of the more hard-wearing tires contain chlorinated, and I suspect in the future why it might well pertain some fluorinated products to get that more, greater durability. And whenever you introduce chlorine into a material that's burnt, you're going to have as a byproduct chlorinated dioxins and furans, dioxins and furans, which are the most toxic substances that we've ever managed to make in a chemical laboratory. Also, which is problematic for the tire issue, is there's quite a lot of sulfur in tires. And there are sulfur analogs of the dioxins. Now, it's a bit difficult to do this on radio, but one of the key parts of the dioxin molecule is the linking of two benzene rings with two oxygens, or the furan benzene rings with one oxygen. That's an important part of the structure. Well, it's quite possible to replace those oxygens with a sulfur atom and get materials which are just as toxic. However, they're not going to show up. These sulfur analogs of dioxins and furans are not going to show up in the standard methodology, the mass spec chromatography mass spec method of analyzing pollutants that are used for this purpose. They're not going to show up in the same positions, and they're going to be missed unless someone is looking for them. And obviously, the company is not looking for them. The company is not going to look for problems. And unfortunately, the agencies that we need to protect us are more or less asleep at the wheel when it comes to regulating these kind of facilities. Even if the will was there, the finances are not there at the moment for the DEC or any of the other agencies to do a really good scientific job of monitoring them. So once IT gets its permit, that's it. I mean, you're then beholden on a company that's interested in making as much profit as they can, relying on them to monitor their own operations, essentially.
And I guess the other issue is the solid component of what's left at the bottom of the smokestack. And I guess, is there much known about what potential toxicity could result from that?
In the fly ash, that's the fine material which is caught in air pollution control devices, you're going to have not only dioxins and furans and these sulfur analogs of dioxins and furans, but you're also going to get some quite a hefty amount of cadmium, which means that ash then has to be carefully sequestered. No one uses it. No one wants to use it. And so the company probably at this point thinks that they're getting this cheap fuel coming into the front end of their plant. But I wonder how much attention they put into collecting that fly ash carefully, making sure that the workers are protected very well, because if they're exposed to that fine ash without good breathing apparatus and stuff on their skin, they're going to be exposed to it. This is all going to add the hidden expenses to it. And then, of course, the other expenses, well, where do they dump that? Which local landfill is going to be the recipient of that fly ash? On the one hand, that's the stuff that's collected in the air pollution control devices, and the bottom ash, the stuff that falls through the grates, on the other.
When landfills start to fill up, many cities and towns turn to incineration as a solution to their garbage problem. What potential hazards to human health result from incinerating municipal waste?
Again, you will find toxic heavy metals such as mercury and chromium, cadmium, lead, and others that will be emitted, as well as pollutants such as dioxins and furans, because there's a lot of chlorinated materials in municipal waste. So, and then you'll find the benzene derivatives such as the PAHs, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons. So, you know, just depending upon the waste stream and the inefficiency of the municipal waste incinerator, you will see a lot of similar pollutants, but the concentrations and rates will vary.
Because of the need to dispose of potentially contaminated waste, For decades, hospitals and other medical facilities incinerated much of their waste, and some are still doing so. Is incineration of medical waste also harmful?
Medical waste, actually, if you look at the medical waste stream, is very similar to what you see in municipal waste, except perhaps there might be a larger percentage of plastics, especially chlorinated plastics, because of all the disposables in medical waste. The problem, of course, with chlorinated plastics, in particular polyvinyl chloride, is that it's a major source of the production of dioxins and furans. So one thing we do see is that there's a fairly high concentration of dioxins and furans formed in medical waste. In the late 1980s, California had a regulation requiring the quantification of all toxic air emissions from different facilities, including hospitals. And so that's when I started work on testing incinerators in California. And that's when I was when I found out the extent of pollution that they put out. At that time, the concern was primarily dioxins and cadmium, but we also saw quite a bit of mercury, lead, chromium, arsenic, and so on, other heavy metals. And in addition to particulate matter and hydrogen chloride and some of the acid gases, we saw also, of course, dioxins and furans, which was the main concern.
In the incineration of municipal trash, apparently heavy metals actually get into the air, and that seemed kind of surprising since they are heavy. But apparently they can be vaulted into the air, and I guess would they tend to affect communities more in the immediate area? And do you know if that's an issue with incineration of medical waste, heavy metal pollution?
Yeah, what happens when you burn trash is that metals, which are often captured in very stable matrices, for example, cadmium is frequently added to stabilize plastics. It's in pigments and so on. And these things are contained. And if they were thrown into a landfill, they wouldn't, they would take maybe 1,000 years before they leached out of the plastics. On the other hand, when you burn that stuff, you release the cadmium as tiny particles or gases, and off they go. And the metals, you're right in the sense that the metals are, you know, solids. You have to raise to a high temperature before they become gases. But you've got those very high temperatures in the furnace, enough in the primary furnace to vaporize these metals, and then they condense out. And they condense out on the particles, and that's the way they're normally captured, using a particulate control device, either an electrostatic precipitator or a baghouse, a fabric filter. You're capturing the particles, and the toxic metals and other pollutants deposit on those particles as a function of surface area. And so the smallest particles have the highest concentration of the toxic metals. And our concern then is the tiniest particles which escape the air pollution control devices and go out into the air. Those are very, very tiny, and they go deep down into the human lung and very rapidly exchange with the bloodstream, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the concern. Even though they've got better at capturing these toxic metals, you're still hostage to the tiniest particles that escape. You're also hostage to the times when the air pollution control device is not working properly, when the baghouse ruptures, et cetera, some of the bags and their stuff comes out. You've got all that kind of problem. But in addition to all of that, one of the huge problems has been mercury, which, of course, is a liquid at room temperature, easily vaporized, and was not captured by the air pollution control device. It was not captured by particulate control. So for years and years and years, all the mercury that was liberated from the municipal waste stream went straight up the stacks. And that mercury is able to travel very long distances indeed. To answer your question, the mercury can go very, very long distances indeed and tends to follow acid rain. And so this is a problem which is certainly associated with coal-fired power stations from the Midwest. They not only give us acid rain, but they also give us mercury. And in some states, the mercury emissions from trash incinerators is exceeding the mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants. In the late 90s, they began to counteract for that. They started to introduce activated charcoal into their scrubbing systems, and the charcoal does remove some of the mercury. But it, you require so little mercury to contaminate a lake to the point that you can't eat the fish that this is still problematic.
The media that I have, media coverage I've seen of the issue seems to indicate that the opposition to this plant is largely coming from Vermont, which is the probably the closest part of Vermont is maybe 20 or so miles from the plant, maybe 15.
Yeah.
And I guess I wanted to, and I was actually talking with someone who, I have a friend who lives near there, and she said that she can smell the operations of the International Paper Corporation from where she lives in Vermont, and she lives about 30 or so miles from the plant. And obviously, if you're smelling something, that indicates that something is getting in the air over and traveling in that direction.
Yes.
But I guess in watching the media coverage, one of the TV stations that I've that I tune into, the local stations, I know has a tremendous amount of coverage of the New York side of Lake Champlain in their usual broadcasting.
Yeah.
And there seems to be no opposition, or I haven't seen any opposition coming from people who live right around the plant.
No.
And I guess I wanted to get an understanding from you of, I mean, obviously there's politics involved there. They probably don't want to alienate their largest employer in Essex County.
Right.
But I actually wanted to talk more about the physical chemistry of these, what's going to emanate from the smokestack.
Mm-hmm.
If my friend in lives 30 miles east of the plant can smell what's going on, does that necessarily mean that the people who live closer to the plant are not going to be affected by it? Or, in other words, what distances do the various air pollutants coming from the plant tend to travel? Or does it vary by substance, I guess?
Yeah. Well, those are very, very good questions. And to give a thorough answer would probably take a whole tome and several hours. But let's say this. Your friend is completely correct. If you can smell something, then a molecule of a chemical has gone up your nose, and that molecule has come from the paper plant. And that's one of the disadvantages of running a paper plant. They do produce very, very smelly products, and they can be detected by the human nose many miles away. That's very important in this particular case because the dioxin molecule has no odor. It has no taste, no color, and no odor, so the average person is not going to detect it. I suspect that one of the problems with the local communities is what you've said, number one, is that this is a local employer and they don't want to get them upset, so they're not going to challenge anything. Secondly, those people have already taken this bargain of living near a very smelly operation, and therefore, when they hear about more pollution, they've already crossed that bridge, and they're going to be probably immune to any other notion, especially if it's coupled with some nice positive news about saving money on fuel, that kind of thing. But let's look at that physical chemistry for a moment, because typically when someone looks at a smokestack of a paper mill or an incinerator or what have you, they look at that stack and they say dilution. You see how big that stack is? By the time that stuff gets down to me, it will be so dilute, it's not going to hurt me, thank goodness. We do have this complication of being able to smell something 20 or 30 miles away. Now, the problem with that is that nature reconcentrates some of these toxics, in particular the dioxins and the furans and the mercury. If you were dealing with a trash incinerator or a coal-fired power plant, you'd be concerned about mercury concentrating in the fish. That is a problem for Lake Champlain of concern. Now, let me give you some notion of the dimensions of this problem. A cow in one day puts as much dioxin into its body as it would take you, with breathing the air, 14 years to put into your body. In other words, one day's consumption of grass, we're talking about a freely grazing cow on out in a field by munching on that grass, and that grass is acting as a huge collection area for the dioxin on the particles which are falling onto that grass. It's putting this huge amount of dioxin into its body, and then that dioxin is now protected. It concentrates in the fat of the animal, it goes into its meat, and it goes into its milk. It's a wonderful collection and re-delivery device of dioxins to the human species. So that's the problem. A colleague and I, Tom Webster, did a calculation on this back in 1986, which we presented to an international forum on dioxin. We calculated then that 1 quart of cow's milk was the equivalent of 8 months of breathing next to the cow. 8 months of breathing. In other words, you don't have to live in Ticonderoga or in the immediate area to experience the dioxin that's coming out of the stack. What we should be concerned about is the contamination of any agriculture in the area. So the dairy farmers and the pig producers, the chicken producers, farm product producers in a very large area downwind of that plant should be concerned, because they are going to have an increment in the amount of dioxin in the animal fat that they are producing. And it is not a hidden secret that, number one, the average person's the most dioxin that most people get today is coming from animal fat, and we're already over any rationally based allowable daily intake for dioxin simply from the food that we consume. And number two, most of that is coming from combustion of trash in municipal waste incinerators, combustion of hazardous waste in chemical waste incinerators, backyard burn barrels. When you burn your trash outside, it's one of the worst things that any individual could do as far as environmental pollution, because you're generating these very toxic byproducts. And if you do it in a rural area, you're putting it, and often you'll see burn barrels with the smoke streaming across the adjacent field, and often, more often than not, you can see cows grazing in that field, and that's straight into the food chains, straight into to human beings. So that's the problem in a nutshell, that the biggest source of pollution of dioxins and furans is from the food chains, and these lovely green fields that we see in Vermont are huge catchment areas for that pollution. And that's the first part of this ugly story. The second part of the ugly story now takes us away from physical chemistry to biology, and that is that once you get these dioxins and furans into your body, the normal detoxification method that nature has, largely in the liver, protection against fat-soluble toxics, which dioxin is one, is to convert it as quickly as possible into a water-soluble product, metabolite. Once the body has converted it from fat-soluble to water-soluble, then we can get rid of it. We can excrete it through the kidney, and that is the normal process for handling pharmaceutical drugs, many air pollutants, many pesticides, etc. But it doesn't work for dioxins. It doesn't work for PCBs. It doesn't work for dioxins. It doesn't work for many chlorinated pesticides. So what happens? Well, it means we can't get them out of our body. So what happens? They accumulate in our fat. And for a man, you can't get rid of them. They accumulate in the fat, and they get more and more concentrated over your whole lifespan. For a woman, however, she can get rid of them. It's called having a baby. So she's accumulating these dioxins, furans, PCBs, brominated diphenyl ethers into a fat. And then after 20 years of accumulation, 25 years of accumulation, when she has her first baby, those dioxins, etc., move from her body fat into the fetus. And that's the real issue. This is why scientists are very, very concerned about dioxins, furans, and many other substances which are commonly added to plastics and cosmetics and God knows what else. The highest doses are going to the fetus. They're known to be endocrine disrupting chemicals. That means they interfere with hormonal signals, and hormonal signals are absolutely paramount during fetal development in getting the baby to develop in the correct way. And this probably is beginning to scare people a lot, and I don't wish to do that. I think that, thank God, because citizens organized to stop the building of literally hundreds of planned incinerators in this country in the 80s, we stopped over 300 from being built since 1985. Because that happened, and because also the ones which were built were forced to put more and more sophisticated air pollution control devices on, I think we cut this problem off at the pass, as it were, and we haven't gone. I think that the levels of dioxins, etc., in mother's milk is now beginning to come down, which is really good news. But we can't afford to be cavalier about this. We can't afford to let our attention slip and let these tire burning operations, etc., slip under the carpet.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. Our guests have been Paul Connett, Jorge Emanuel, and Neil Carman, three experts on waste incineration. After the break, Peter Orris will be joining us to explore the medical effects of incineration. And later in the show, our three guests will be returning to discuss the alternatives to incineration. So stay with us. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. We've been joined by Paul Connett, Jorge Emanuel, and Neil Carman in a discussion of waste incineration. They'll be rejoining us later in the show, but for the next few minutes, we have a fourth guest here to discuss the medical effects of incineration products. Peter Orris is a medical doctor and professor of environmental and occupational health at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and an expert in the area of the medical effects of waste incineration products. Peter Orris, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you very much.
We've heard from our other three guests about the various substances that emanate from the smokestacks of waste incinerators. So let's start right in focusing on some of the most feared of these substances, the dioxins and furans.
They're a family, of course, of chemicals. They include as well a few of the polychlorinated biphenols in the group, which are entitled dioxin-like PCBs. And I guess we would start with carcinogenic effects, and that is that several of them are known or suspected human carcinogens. In other words, they cause cancer in human beings. In addition, they are multi-organ system toxins, and that is that they disrupt several of the chemical processes in the body and impact on neurodevelopment in children at very low doses, and that's what we're primarily concerned about. There's much about the health effects of these chemicals that we don't fully understand. This is because they operate primarily through a toxic mechanism that we describe as endocrine disruption. In other words, they get involved in the endocrine system in the human body, which is one of the reasons that they are toxic at such low levels, much lower than previously identified for other chemicals.
And then another component of concern, particularly for rubber incineration, that Dr. Carman mentioned, was production of a large amount of sulfur dioxide.
Yeah, well, the sulfur compounds in general are problematical for people with respiratory ailments, with asthma, with chronic respiratory diseases. They are quite irritant in nature. Several of the sulfur compounds, which are heavier than air, can be asphyxiants in different settings. And so these compounds as well, they cause a more acute effect. They don't bioaccumulate the way the first group do. But when you are incinerating in a community, these are often the first kinds of effects that you see and often target the most vulnerable in the communities, the very young, those with asthma, and the very old with obstructive lung disease.
And I guess the last group that's been of concern is the heavy metals, including mercury, lead, cadmium, and chromium. And I was wondering if what the toxicity of those elements are.
Yeah, the heavy metals are a family with similar toxicities, though each individual one has its own characteristics. Cadmium has a variety of toxicities to it. We often are most concerned with its kidney effects. We know the most about lead, and the more we learn about lead, the more we are concerned about it as a neurotoxin again for children. In other words, a developmental effect on on a child's brain. And we know that the lead, at whatever level is identified, all the way down to zero, has some effect on, if you will, dampening the child's intellectual functioning. The higher the level, the more dampening, the more impairment that occurs. It turns out as well that mercury behaves similarly, but it is slightly more complex because the elemental mercury itself, the mercury that is the metal, is not our primary concern toxicologically in the environment at low levels. But what occurs is that every time the elemental mercury is released into the environment, it is metabolized by small microorganisms. And then it is methylated or organified, if you will, and methyl mercury or organic mercury is a very significant neurotoxin, again, at low dose levels. For women who are pregnant, thinking about getting pregnant, every increased amount of mercury seems to have an effect on the developing child's brain. And that's a significant problem for us. That is why in the Great Lakes states there are advisories about Great Lakes fish and limiting ingestion of Great Lakes fish to one or two meals a month, depending on what is the type of fish involved. This, of course, for mercury applies as well to deep sea fish and other marine fish where we are finding higher levels than we would like. Tuna is an excellent example of a problem there. Another detail with respect to the mercury, while the PCBs and the dioxins may be able to be reduced by reducing the fat in your preparation of fish, mercury builds up in a variety of tissues, and it can't be reduced through that methodology.
Is incineration an important cause of mercury in the environment, including in fish?
Yeah, incineration and specifically medical incineration accounts for about 10% of the mercury. Municipal incineration accounts for a significant quantity more than that. Incineration is a very effective method to put this rather volatile metal up into the air so it diffuses through the environment and, deposits in a much wider area. So incineration is one of the most efficient means, if you will, to poison the environment with this stuff.
Well, Peter Orris, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Those who have promoted the incineration of waste have always pointed out that it's a simple solution to dealing with solid waste, that it's by far the most cost-effective means, and that alternatives are expensive and just not practical. So I'd like to switch gears at this point and devote the remainder of the show to looking at that question. Are there practical alternatives to incinerating solid waste? Now, earlier in today's show, we found out that incineration of medical waste is actually a very toxic process, produces unusually large amounts of dioxins and mercury. So perhaps we can start off the discussion by looking at the approaches that hospitals and other medical facilities are using to obviate the need to incinerate their waste.
When you look at the typical waste stream from a hospital, there's only about anywhere from 5 to at most 15% of the waste that really needs to be treated in a special way. The vast majority of the waste is often it's even cleaner than household waste, and so much of that waste could be handled through waste minimization methods, including reducing things at the sources. A lot of the waste might be packaging, for example, and more hospitals now are trying to work with their vendors to reduce the amount of packaging and reduce that waste stream. And there's a lot that people can do in hospitals and have done in terms of recycling of their waste and even composting of kitchen waste and other waste that you find in hospitals. That small percentage that's actually infectious waste, that could be treated through a number of alternatives. And the major ones include autoclaves or specially designed autoclaves that include shredding and mixing inside the autoclave, as well as some microwave technologies. And there are a few chemical technologies that are also being used to deal specifically with pathological waste, tissues and body parts and so on that also need to be taken care of.
And are these technologies actually happening in most hospitals across the country, or is this just state of the art that's only slowly being adopted?
Oh, no. Actually, many of these alternative technologies have been around for decades. And with the closure of a lot of incinerators in the last decade, the bulk of the medical waste is now being treated in these alternative technologies.
You can save money doing this as well, right?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We've looked at some of the cost comparisons. In fact, I think about 10 years ago, a number of us had compared what it would take for hospitals to even upgrade their incinerators versus simply getting the alternative technologies. And we found that the cost of adding scrubbers and baghouse filters to existing technologies was going to be more than simply getting one of these alternative technologies. The autoclaves in particular are fairly very cost-effective, certainly compared to incineration.
Well, let's turn to the municipal waste dilemma. How do we safely dispose of the many products of modern civilization when we're done using them? Perhaps we can start out by returning to the incineration of tires, which is the issue we began with. Since all the experts on today's show, you all have said that you view incineration of tires as too toxic to allow, then what are the alternatives?
If you were to go north to Nova Scotia, you will find a tire recycling facility which is handling nearly 1 million tires every year in Nova Scotia. Practically every tire that is collected in Nova Scotia is recycled using a cryogenic method where the tires are shredded and then the lumps are fed through a tunnel cooled with liquid nitrogen. That makes the rubber very, very brittle, and it's dropped through a hammer mill, and the nylon belts end up as becoming fluff, which is sucked off, and the steel strips end up as little strips of metal, which is removed with a belt magnet, and the crumb rubber is left as tiny, tiny pieces of rubber. You haven't changed the properties, the chemical properties of that rubber at all. It goes through a series of cleaning processes, and that crumb rubber is then used to feed into material which is used in indoor running tracks, outdoor running tracks, the base of AstroTurf, in asphalt, and a number of other useful uses. So it can be done, and it is being done, and I know the government of Nova Scotia is delighted with this whole operation, but there's absolutely no reason why this material, there are many, many other uses could not be found for this material. now that we reach the 21st century, we should be much, much more conscious of recovering materials than destroying materials, which is what you're doing. When you burn those tires, you're destroying resources. And I think it's a lack of government vision that, and the reason that we have that vision is that so many governments put their reliance on the back end of the problems. They're always the approach in New York State and elsewhere is, how do we get rid of these things? It's always, how do we get rid of it? And so when the IT company or other companies come through and say, we can help you get rid of your waste, that always is attractive to these rather boring people that think with the wrong end of their bodies, at the back end of the problem. Whereas if they were challenged to move to the front end, we could see some very exciting things. And let me give you some examples of that, because what I'm talking about now, and I know that tires just gives us the entree into this discussion, okay? I'm going beyond tires. I'm going to all the other stuff that people, politicians and bureaucrats, want to put in holes in the ground or into fancy burning machines. Looking at the larger picture, we have to move to the front end of the problem. And the way we do that is with an approach called zero waste. It's the zero waste strategy, which recognizes that the community cannot handle the whole problem. You cannot get 100% recycling based upon the community. Why? Because industry insists upon making packaging and products which are non-recyclable. And we have to change that. We as communities have to maximize what we can reuse, repair, compost, very important, composting, what we can recycle, and, of course, whatever local measures we can take to encourage people to reduce unnecessary packaging, great. Do all that. Back it up with an interim landfill in which you have a screening facility in front of the landfill to take out more stuff that was missed at the first separation cut. And then you put the pressure on industry. We have to say, look, if we can't reuse this, if we can't recycle this, if we can't compost this, you guys shouldn't be making it. Or you should design your products in a way which are compatible with the demands of the 21st century. And this is a classic case. The car manufacturers, the tire manufacturers, why on earth are we allowing these people to make tires without any notion and any responsibility for handling those tires at the end of the day? One step we could contemplate in government is to say to Goodyear or any of these other companies that make tires, you take them back. You put them out, you take them back. That's called extended producer responsibility, and that is very much part of the whole zero-waste strategy, which is the cutting edge of waste, or I would rather call it resource management. So we're living in an age which is still dominated by the paradigm of waste management in the corporate interest instead of resource management in the community and global interest. This is a very much the sort of the touch paper to this discussion. And here, the more progressive companies, more progressive certainly than IT, have got the message. I visited a couple of years ago the Xerox Corporation in the Netherlands. And there, they've taken responsibility for their old copying machines, the trucks which take the new machines in one direction to 16 different countries are taking the old machines back in the opposite direction to a huge production facility in Venray in the Netherlands. And there, they're reusing parts, reusing the whole machine in some cases, replacing parts, reusing parts, recycling materials. Only 5% of those materials are actually being disposed of. The other 95% of the materials in those copying machines is being used or recycled again. And that's a massive operation. When you consider these machines are going to 16 different countries, these machines have over 1,000 pieces in them, and yet they're able to recover 95% of that material. And here is the really exciting information. If you want a win-win situation, this is it. That saved the company, Xerox, $76 million in the year 2000 and continues to do that. I mean, that's the win-win situation. If you get it right at the front end, you don't have these half-cocked measures at the back end of the problem. When companies do it right at the front end, it doesn't cost them more money. It saves them money. It's more a lack of vision and a lack of initiative than a financial imposition. Let me give you another example. Interface Carpet. When the chief executive officer of Interface, which is a multinational company selling modular carpets, read the book The Ecology of Commerce, this is an economist now, Paul Hawkins, The Ecology of Commerce, he said it was like a spear in my side. I determined to make Interface one of the first multinational corporations to be sustainable, truly sustainable multinational corporation. He then got his company to embark on 7 different approaches to reducing the impacts they were having on the environment. This was air pollution, water pollution, solid waste production, energy use, and so on. And he found, or they found, every single thing that they did saved the company money. So as they tried harder and harder to become more and more sustainable, the great news was that they were saving money. There are, in fact, whole car companies which are dedicated to making cars which are going to be 100% reused and recycled. I think some of the German companies are doing that right now. And the immediate effect of that, incidentally, is to increase employment, not to decrease employment, because now you've got to have shifts which dismantle these modular vehicles. When, as soon as you get into designing objects and things like cars with the notion that you're going to have to take these cars back and disassemble and use them again, it's going to change the design and it's going to increase employment. All of that should be welcome. But, of course, it requires the public to get in there and say that we want this. If a car company was to do that on its lonesome, it may feel it's going to lose its competitive position with other car companies that don't do that. They're producing throwaway cars, essentially. And that's where we need the public to get in there and say we do want this.
For listeners who'd like to learn more about the incineration issue in general, tires, plastics, medical waste, and other products of modern civilization, I was wondering if you could recommend some websites.
I can recommend two. The website no-burn.org is the website of the Global Alliance for Incineration Alternatives, and they have a lot of information about the problems with incineration and also the alternatives to incineration. A second website would be noharm.org, and this is the website of Healthcare Without Harm, which is an international organization. It has members in about 40 countries, and it's an organization that's trying to make the healthcare industry more environmentally friendly and no longer a source of harm to the public, which is ironic because we're talking about the healthcare industry. And so noharm.org has a lot of information also about incineration alternatives as well as other methods of what people in the healthcare industry and communities can do to help in the environment, such as being careful with what they do with mercury, finding alternatives to mercury, finding alternatives to other toxic products used in hospitals.
Well, that's all we have time for today. So, Jorge Emanuel, Paul Connett, and Neil Carman, I'd like to thank you all for joining us on Public Health Radio.
You're welcome. Delighted.
My pleasure.
Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.